U.S.-Russia relations on the rocks, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. No agreement on Syria, a plutonium deal halted, accusations of election meddling. Things aren't so good right now between the U.S. and Russia.
This is an unsustainable state. It's a dangerous state when there are so many threats that the United States and Russia have to deal with.
Plus, our reporter asks a Pennsylvania farmer which presidential candidate he believes.
Wow, who do I believe?
And what was that Nobel Prize in Physics for again?
Theoretical discoveries of topological phase transitions and topological phases of matter.
Now imagine turning that into a painting. It's all ahead on The World. We begin the show today with the sorry state of U.S.-Russian relations. It's something that may well be high on the agenda for whoever wins the White House in November. Yesterday, the U.S. broke off talks with Russia aimed at halting the war in Syria. The Obama administration is at odds with the Kremlin's continued military support for the Syrian regime. Meanwhile, Moscow decided to suspend a long-running agreement between the two nations to dispose of weapons-grade plutonium. For more on all this, we turn to Svetlana Savranska. She directs Russian programs at the National Security Archive at George Washington University. Just what do you make of the trajectory here and of this moment?
The trajectory, of course, is a sad trajectory. And I think that the latest move with Putin declaring the end to the plutonium agreement is more of a symbol of where the U.S.-Russian relations are going right now. I don't think that substantively it is such a huge, crucial break, but it just is intended as a punishment to the United States for a series of steps that Russia sees as hostile and provoking. That includes, of course, the sanctions that were applied after the annexation of Crimea. That includes the U.S. plans to build the theater missile defense in East European countries.
How do you read this move by Russian President Vladimir Putin? Do you think it's just rhetoric or do you think it's real?
Oh, it is real. It is a very decisive step, I would say even radical step. But the actual substance of this step is that Russia will stop participating in the agreement that, in fact, never worked because the United States recently decided not to dispose of the plutonium by the exact methodology that was described in the agreement. So there were doubts about this methodology for a long time. So it was not even sure that the agreement would have ever worked. What it means is that Russia is pretty much seizing any security cooperation with the present administration. It's a signal to the United States that all cooperation in the security sphere with the present administration will be stopped, terminated, until the United States shows willingness to cooperate more on the Russian terms across the board. And this is a very unfortunate state because it's coming after 25 years of very successful cooperation between the United States and Russia in the framework of the program of Non-Lugar, the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. We had incredibly successful cooperation within the program of megatons to megawatts, disposing of the weapon-grade, highly enriched uranium, which Russia was selling to the United States to power peaceful nuclear reactors, which, again, was a very successful program. And when the plutonium disposal program was signed, it was also a very successful program, as signed, but it never actually worked as it was intended to work. So what's stopping here is not so much the plutonium disposal, but the entire across-the-board U.S.-Russian cooperation on strategic matters.
And just how dangerous is this?
I think it is dangerous. And you see a lot of experts on both sides speaking about potential even for accidental nuclear conflict. I wouldn't probably go that far, but you know, if you look at the last 30 years, we are in a very dangerous space because practically all security cooperation has been taken to almost zero. Also, the attitudes to America and Russia and attitudes to Russia and America are at the all-time low. There is such huge distrust, inability to talk to each other among the people who, even in their own background, have experience of cooperating. And that worries me a lot. I do think that this is an unsustainable state. It's a dangerous state when there are so many other threats that the United States and Russia have to deal with cooperatively. But I think, you know, we do have these 25 years of very productive cooperation in the security area between Russia and the United States. And the knowledge of that cooperation, the people who were engaged in this cooperation are still around. And I hope they just get back to work and address these issues and try to hold back their negative images of each other.
Svetlana Savranska of the National Security Archive at George Washington University, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We mentioned Syria earlier. Russia is supporting the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and both Russian and Syrian forces have been criticized for bombing civilians in rebel-held areas. That's well documented in media reports, too. But some people think the Western media's portrayal of the war in Syria is all wrong.
The Syrian government insists that they are fighting terrorism on behalf of the entire world, and there is some truth to that.
That's Michael Bashara, a Syrian-American who lives in upstate New York. Bashara was born in the U.S., but remains in touch with relatives and friends back in Syria. He says U.S. media outlets only see the war from the rebel point of view.
They only cover the suffering of one side of the Syrian conflict. They only cover the suffering of the people in those rebel-held areas. And when they do cover the suffering of the people in the government-held areas, they dehumanize the people. Back in June, for example, when Tartus and Jable, which are on the coast of Syria, were bombed by ISIS, essentially all the news outlets described the people that were bombed in these places as an Assad stronghold. It sounds like a military target, like they're bombing a military base, like they're bombing, quote-unquote, Assad's people. When in reality, they're bombing ordinary civilians like me and you trying to go along with their everyday life.
Maybe you can help us understand that by telling us the reality people are living who you do know. You have family and friends in Syria, is that right?
Yeah. The rebels in the outskirts of Damascus, they shell the city indiscriminately and they shell neighborhoods with rockets, and then they hide in neighborhoods. At any time, a mortar shell can fall and hit people and kill them or disable them.
What is your greatest fear for Syria's future?
The Islamists take over, then all the religious minorities in Syria then will be oppressed. They'll be second-class citizens. You know, I'm a Syrian Christian, so that point of view really resonates with me. I believe in democracy and the principles of liberty. I really would wish for the Syrian people to get the greatest chance at this liberty, and that's not going to happen with this revolution, with these Islamic rebels.
Do you support, and do your family and friends support, Bashar al-Assad's leadership?
This is a common misconception among the Western media that by supporting the Syrian military and the Syrian government, you are supporting one man. You are supporting Bashar al-Assad. But the problem isn't even the guy as much as it is the political system. This is something that must be resolved among the Syrian people. This is not something that must be resolved among the Americans or among the Russians or among the British or among the Saudis. These political problems should be resolved in Syria with Syrians only and no one else. So when people say, do I support Bashar al-Assad? I mean, no, not necessarily, but that's not up for me to decide. That's up for the Syrian people as a whole to decide.
Do you think you can go back from this now? We have the United States involved, Russia involved. I can hear what you're saying, but there's a very intricate, complicated mess now.
Yeah, it's very unlikely that international influence will subside anytime soon. But my hope for Syria is that they can create a national unity government and guarantee a constitution where everyone has equal rights and pure secularism. Because when it's secular, you won't be like Saudi Arabia, where women can't even drive, for example, and where Christians are clearly second-class citizens in that country and other Islamist countries.
So the United States would say that it has identified and is working with moderate groups under the umbrella of the Free Syria Army, and they do describe their beliefs as in opposition to religious extremism. Do you think they're misrepresenting their beliefs?
I think the State Department tries really hard to find these groups, what's left of them, which is a very small percentage. But unfortunately, these pro-secular democratic groups do not have any power on the ground in Syria. To say that there could be moderates, we have to help the moderates, is not practical.
Just to close, is there one email, one image, one tweet you've seen or received that sticks with you?
Essentially, what sticks with me with this war, it's the human cost. We're all humans, you know, regardless of whether you're on this side or that side. So when you get killed, it's you're human. It's like anyone else getting killed. Everyone is equally human.
Michael Bashara, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Michael Bashara is a Syrian-American who lives in upstate New York. In a few minutes, how some Syrian refugees are trying to start again in Denmark. Let's shift focus now to Saudi Arabia. The government there just made a big decision. It's switching from an Islamic calendar to a Western one as a basis for public servants' salary. The Western calendar is 11 days longer, so under the new system, many workers will have to work longer for the same amount of money. The pay cut is part of bigger changes in oil-rich Saudi Arabia, designed to save the kingdom money. Joseph Kashishian is with the King Faisal Center for Research and Islamic Studies in Saudi Arabia. Why is the government trying to cut costs like this?
Simply because there are too many expenses that have to be settled. The subsidies are accumulating and the price of oil is down. It surprised a lot of people because some people are going to hurt as a result of these latest decision.
Now, the calendar caught our eye, but what other spending cutbacks are being put in place?
Well, the biggest cutbacks that are being introduced have to do with the subsidies over electricity and water. Ridiculously low prices for decades are being adjusted right now simply because just the subsidies that the government pays for electricity, water, even gasoline, amount to nearly $60 billion per year. This has been going on for decades, and there is just not that kind of revenue anymore to be able to afford this kind of welfare system.
Saudi has a reputation of being one of the most strictly religious states in the world. Is the switch away from an Islamic calendar, how is it being received by religious conservatives?
I wouldn't be surprised if they were to kind of vent a little bit, if you would like. But at the end of the day, this is an economic decision. So therefore, the religious folks can complain if they would like to, but I think that the economic prerogatives are going to override them.
Now, are you a public servant at the King Faisal Center? Does the calendar change affect your pay?
It affects my pay, but fortunately, not that much.
What changes will you have to make in your life?
you know, I haven't given this any thoughts, to be honest with you. I make enough to live on. I should not complain. But there are people who will hurt. I'm aware of that. But on the other hand, when we think about Saudi households, we oftentimes make the comparison that their households are similar to ours in the United States or in Western Europe, where you have a nuclear family, maybe a father, a mother, a couple of kids, maybe even less than that. Whereas in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, families tend to be fairly large, and a lot of people living under the same roof, which means that one salary cutback is going to affect a lot of people, but time will tell, of course.
Joseph Kashishian, thank you for telling us about this.
My pleasure.
Joseph Kashishian is with the King Faisal Center for Research and Islamic Studies in Saudi Arabia. Coming up, an American soccer coach tackles the Premier League. You're with the world. Parts of the Syrian city of Aleppo were under heavy bombardment today, and that's pretty much a normal day in Aleppo these days. That got reporter Sonia Narang thinking about some refugees from Aleppo she met this summer in Denmark.
I meet Mohammed Sheikh Ali and his family at a summer camp in the countryside. It's designed to make refugees feel welcome. They're gathered around a bonfire, baking bread over the hot coals. Back in Syria, Ali was an electrical engineer, supervising 200 maintenance workers at a large electricity company.
I was responsible for any malfunctioning of the electricity network in all of Aleppo. I lost a lot of workers. Whenever I'd send them out and there were airstrikes, two or three were killed. The others would blame me.
Mohammed felt trapped between government and rebel forces. He got service calls for repairs from both sides.
While doing that job, I was always targeted. They could just kidnap me and no one would ever find me.
3 years ago, he left Syria alone on a grueling journey to Europe by boat, truck, and foot.
I heard that it's easier to reunite families in Scandinavian countries. I was heading for Sweden, but I got really tired. I reached Copenhagen, and I was too exhausted to continue onwards.
Within months, he received his resident permit to stay in Denmark. Then he sent for his family to join him.
I was counting the days for them to come here. I was breathlessly waiting, and I kept telling myself, I have to be patient.
A year later, Mohammed's wife, Asya, and kids finally boarded a plane bound for Copenhagen. She remembers how happy she was. Before, we'd never been apart, she says, not even for 1 or 2 weeks. I felt this was a new beginning for my children. The family now lives in the rural town of Frederiksberg. They're happy about their new lives and seem to be doing well. But I met other refugees in Denmark who don't feel as welcome. In Copenhagen, I walk around the city center with Abdullah Tuma. He's 27 and also from Aleppo, where he studied French literature. He misses Syria and says he feels a coldness here he's never felt before.
They don't want us. I don't want. When I talk with my friend in the work, he told me, of course we don't need a refugee. We don't need. He told me clearly.
He says he spent his first year in Denmark smiling and trying to be cordial, but no one responded. People wouldn't even sit next to him on the train. Now he's a lot more quiet and reserved. It's his day off today, so he's with his housemate, who's also Syrian. But it's hard for them to relax. They can't stop thinking about the war back home.
We not celebrate so much because of our situation.
You're not so...
We not celebrate.
As we walk, no one smiles or talks to them in the streets until we bump into a Lebanese man they know near the train station. He shakes their hands, and they start to chat excitedly like old friends. He tells me he misses this kind of camaraderie. Attitudes towards refugees have hardened here, according to Eva Singer of the Danish Refugee Council.
A lot of Danish people feel a bit threatened by the many newcomers. We can't pretend that that is not the case.
This year, the government tightened immigration policies to discourage asylum seekers from coming to Denmark. It now takes much longer for families to be reunited, at least 3 years or more. The Ali family was lucky to come when they did. Back at the summer camp, they're learning to play percussion like the group Stomp. Mohammed and the children clap, while their mom, Asya, watches and smiles. Asya says she's comfortable here, and the people are kinder than she'd imagined. But she can't get the war out of her head. I think about those who I left back in Syria, she says. When I first arrived, I didn't think about it a lot. But the war is getting worse and worse. So it's on my mind every single moment, she says. For the World, Sonia Narang, Copenhagen.
England's Premier League is considered by many to be the top soccer league on the planet, and its teams are led by top coaches from all over the globe, but never an American until this week, when Premier League team Swansea City hired former U.S. men's national team coach Bob Bradley. The world soccer guy William Troop says this is big news for U.S. soccer.
It's an opportunity to kind of prove that an American can coach at the highest level. So it could open a lot of doors for a lot of other coaches and players down the line.
So how did Bob Bradley get this job? He got swooped up from the French second division. That's quite a promotion.
Yeah, it's a big jump. Well, one answer is that a lot of people think that this would not have happened if earlier this year Swansea hadn't been taken over by a group of American owners who have experience in Major League Soccer and also in the NBA here in the U.S. And they, you know, at the very least were open to the idea of hiring an American to take over their team.
So why haven't U.S. coaches been hired until now?
So I think the answer to that is that U.S. coaches don't have the track record in a league like the Premier League or any of the other top leagues in the world, which many of them are in Europe. But Bob Bradley has something in his pocket that gives him a little bit of a pedigree. He actually is the first American coach who went and coached in a not a top-level European league, but one of the European leagues. He went to coach a team called Stabæk in Norway. That was just a few years ago, and he did really well. He took a team that was struggling, brought him up to third in the league within Norway, and qualified for a Europe-wide competition. That kind of got noticed. But Bradley's main background is coaching national teams. And he coached the U.S. national team to a pretty good showing, I would say, at the 2010 World Cup. They got past a group that included England, and the U.S. came out on top of that group above England. So that got noticed in the U.K. And then he coached also the Egyptian national team right after the Arab Spring. And that was not an easy thing to do.
That's why I recognize his name.
Yeah, and he actually, at a time of great turmoil in Egypt, he actually organized, you know, a pretty successful run to qualify for the 2014 Cup until he got to, like, a decisive playoff game and he lost. So basically, under Bradley, Egypt won 7 out of 8 games, but that one loss was the one that mattered, and Egypt did not make it to the World Cup under Bradley. So he's got a lot to prove still.
And how do you think Bob Bradley will do in the Premier League?
I think he's got a 50-50 chance of making it. I think it's a tall order for him, and it's a tough league. And, you know, I think I give him a month to prove that he can actually do it. And his first game in charge with Swansea is going to be against one of the top teams in the league, Arsenal from London. If he can do well, then he'll set himself up to do well in the next few games.
William, you're so intrigued by this. I mean, I can see in your face. You love soccer and you're so intrigued by this. But what's the crux of what's happening here?
I think what I find really fascinating here is that we've had a major market for soccer that really hasn't appreciated what American soccer has done over the past few years and how American soccer is not, you know, as bad as people think over in Europe or in Latin America. American soccer has improved a lot. There's much better play. There's better coaching, better players. And this is a chance, really kind of unique chance, for an American to go somewhere at the top of this sport and kind of prove that Americans can compete in this sport.
The World Soccer Guy, William Troop, thank you.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp. For many GIs in Vietnam, this is a familiar voice.
How are you, G.I. Joe?
The silky voice of the communist propaganda machine.
Nothing is more confused than to be ordered into a war to die without the faintest idea of what's going on.
Remembering Hanoi Hannah today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Colombian government isn't giving up on peace. It says it's still committed to a negotiated peace settlement with the Marxist rebel group known as the FARC. That's despite Sunday's shocking referendum result in Colombia. A slim majority of voters chose to reject a peace agreement already negotiated with the FARC. The outcome stunned many Colombians who thought the Yes camp would win easily, officially ending 52 years of conflict in the country. Now, no one's quite sure what happens next. We wanted to hear from someone who voted no on Sunday, so we reached out to Milton Sanchez, a Colombian who lives in Washington, D.C.
I vote no because I believe that the way the government present this agreement was false. They are talking about peace, and we were not signing for peace. We were signing for an agreement, and that had several issues that people like me as a victim, people that understand the conflict, cannot just accept. And I felt that the government ignored several positions that were against this agreement. And I think that many people, as me, we share that feeling of rejection, being ignored, and not taking the appropriate steps to include every Colombian in that agreement. And that includes people from churches, people from other communities, many different views that at the end we say we don't agree with this type of injustice.
You said that you were a victim. What is the story of your family?
Usually I don't talk that much, especially in social media, but years ago in Colombia, a guerrilla kidnapped my father, also tortured him, and he was dead in a horrible circumstances. That was one of the reasons to move from Colombia. And what I have seen is that people say, oh, because you live in the city, or you don't understand the conflict, or you live away, you cannot suffer the same that the people in the towns over there in Colombia suffer. But I think that everyone has some pain, very bad experiences, very traumatic experiences from this conflict. Nobody wants war. And people that vote, no, we are not saying we want war. We want an agreement. We want peace, but authentic peace.
Why does it feel fake to you?
From the beginning, we have seen this kind of pride from government, this pride from guerrillas not admitting that they make mistakes. Recently, just the first day that I heard Timochenko saying...
This is the FARC leader.
The FARC leader asking about forgiveness was until a few weeks ago before this election. And you can see guerrillas asking for forgiveness to the towns just days before elections. So everyone, instead of making me think that they were having truly actions, I think that the effect was different. Everyone thought this is just a show, and they are just trying to put this kind of or playing with the feelings of the people and the victims just right before the elections to convince people to vote for peace. And we received a threat from government, like if there is not agreement, war will be in the cities next day. And fortunately, everyone wants the peace. Everyone is negotiating. Nobody's talking about war.
Milton, was the idea of FARC members receiving amnesty part of why you voted no? Was it just beyond the pale to you?
This is one of the toughest questions. I believe people change. I believe people deserve chances. I believe that many people that make horrible things in the jungle there in Colombia was because they were unaware of all the situation. They were victims too. Many of them were killing people at the age of 15 years old, 17 years old, following orders from people like Timochenko that was taking advantage of this situation. But not everyone, because we really know that many of them are also, not many of them, but the leaders are narco-traffickers. They want to continue the business of cocaine. They are not being honest talking about how much money they have. They were not honest talking about how many children they had in the army of the FARC, and they didn't return all those children and young people in the appropriate way. So all of that is a lie that many people, you don't need to be an expert in political science to understand how they are playing with the system. And the worst is that the president didn't respect the people in Colombia, but they just allow these things happen in order for him to get what he wants.
So given your reservations, this is going to continue, right? And both sides are continuing discussions. What would it take for you to vote yes in the future?
I think that everyone needs to be involved in this process. When people go and sit together, they need to be heard. They cannot be ignored anymore like they did before, because Colombia is for everyone.
Milton Sanchez, a Colombian who lives here in the U.S., thanks so much.
Thank you.
Vice presidential candidates Mike Pence and Tim Kaine are getting ready for their one and only debate tonight in Virginia. There's a long list of topics they can spar over, but when it comes to trade, the two candidates at the top of their respective tickets agree on one thing. They both say they're opposed to the TPP. That's the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership championed by President Obama. In fact, in this election, candidates are falling over each other to distance themselves from all trade deals. And that doesn't make a lot of sense to some farmers that the world's Jason Margolis met in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania is a critical swing state, and the presidential candidates have been spending a lot of time here. But away from the cities and campaign stops, you'll find Mark Fulton's dairy farm, not far from Gettysburg.
The farm has been in the family since 1950, and from there we started with 20 cows and have expanded to 100.
Fulton, his dad, and one full-time employee milk their cows at 4 in the morning and again at 4 in the afternoon, every day, 365 days a year. A tanker truck comes by and picks up their milk every other day. If prices are low, and they've been low for a while, Fulton's still got to milk his cows.
One year in the past 5 years, we did well. We made money. The other four break even or you lose money. So I know they claim if you do a five-year average, they say you make money, but it's really hard when the year you made money was 5 years ago.
Fulton's been losing money in part because there's an oversupply of milk in the U.S. But if the Trans-Pacific Partnership were passed, more countries would want his dairy products. Here's how it would work. Right now, when American dairy products go to Japan, they're slapped with high tariffs.
It's between 30 and 35% on butter and cheese.
That's agricultural economist Everett Peterson at Virginia Tech University. The TPP would gradually remove tariffs, making American butter and cheese 30 to 35% cheaper, and therefore more attractive to Japanese consumers. That's if the TPP is ratified. Jason Grant, also at Virginia Tech, explains what would happen if the U.S. doesn't join the 12-nation trading bloc.
And Japan continues with its separate bilateral agreements with Australia and New Zealand. The U.S. is going to be put at a competitive disadvantage. You know, our products will look relatively more expensive if we do not participate in this agreement.
It's not just Pennsylvania dairy farmers watching the TPP. American corn growers could sell more to Vietnam. Wheat growers could tap into the Malaysian market. And pork producers could find more buyers in New Zealand. Mark O'Neill with the Pennsylvania Farm Bureau says we're talking big numbers for American farmers.
Farm Bureau economists have projected that nationwide it would increase farm income by $4.4 billion when the TPP is fully implemented. Here in Pennsylvania, we're looking at $177 million per year.
And that extra income could translate into jobs on the farm, some 40,000 nationwide. Now, that's the sticking point of the TPP, jobs. Labor organizations oppose the trade deal. One economic study concludes that the TPP could cost the U.S. 450,000 jobs. The Obama administration concedes that jobs would be lost, but argues that the TPP would create new ones, too. For instance, on Mark Fulton's dairy farm.
Farming may be tough, but I do believe it's a good job to have. There's lots of benefits to it. A little more money in our pocket, that would be a great way to expand the business, help create a couple jobs.
Fulton is passionate about farming and food, but many argue that jobs like milking cows don't replace higher-paying work in manufacturing, for example. Bottom line, trade deals always produce winners and losers. On the farm, they get that. Matthew Meals in Newville, Pennsylvania, raises beef cattle. The TPP could open the door to a lot more beef exports. Meals says the trade agreement has become one of his top concerns.
And I hope that whoever is currently in office or whoever will be in the future takes a look at it for what it is and not part of a more political agenda.
Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are very vocal about how much they dislike the TPP, but both also say they're looking out for the interests of farmers. I asked Meals which candidate he believes.
Wow. Who do I believe?
Why did you laugh when I said, who do you believe?
Did it again. Yeah, it's interesting.
He says it's interesting what you hear on the campaign trail and what policies come out in the end. American farmers are less than 2% of the population, and they understand politicians are addressing a larger audience this fall. But they're hoping that when campaign politics end in a few weeks, farm interests will again be taken more seriously. For The World, Jason Margolis, Newville, Pennsylvania.
Life is all about trade-offs. You do one thing, you can't do something else. That's also true about the environment and natural resources. Different people might have different ideas about which resources are more valuable, and that's the crux of our next story. It's about a place in Mexico that's home to a community of fishermen and endangered sea creatures. But this place also has a valuable resource that the world needs more of, and there's concern that extracting that resource could put those other things at risk. Here's reporter Nina Feldman.
The view from the sleepy town of San Juanico is about what you'd get from any village along the Pacific coast of Baja. Craggy coves, turquoise waves, a couple of surfers and fishing boats. But 25 miles offshore, there is something different. The sediment at the bottom of the sea out there is rich in phosphate, a mineral form of phosphorus. And it's really important stuff.
Crop growth anywhere in the world requires phosphorus.
That's Dana Cordell. She runs an outfit called the Global Phosphorus Research Initiative in Australia. I called her up because a group of Mexican and American companies wants to dredge up that phosphate off the coast of San Juanico. But none of the companies would talk to me about their project. So I needed someone else to tell me why they might want to dig it up.
Due to the huge population that we have today, in order to achieve those yields that we need from our food production system, we do need to add external chemical fertilizers.
And phosphate is essential for those chemical fertilizers. Until now, we've mostly been getting it from phosphate rock on land. But we're using up those supplies fast. That's got a lot of people worried about a supply crunch.
If phosphorus was to become more scarce and the prices were to rise, well, that would mean more farmers wouldn't be able to grow the food that feeds the global population.
The mine off San Juanico would be the world's first underwater phosphate mine. In their PR for the project, two of the companies behind it, called Altos Hornos de México and Odyssey Marine Explorations, say the mine would allow Mexico to cut its dependence on phosphate imports and strengthen the country's food security. Seems like a good plan, right? Except to folks who are worried about this stretch of Mexico's coast.
Yo me llamo Juan Luis Murillo Aguilar.
Juan Luis Aguilar is a fisherman from San Juanico. He's been working the water here for more than 30 years, and he's part of a fishing cooperative that's trying to stop the mining project.
Aquí se nos acabaría todo. No habría turismo.
Aguilar is worried that the dredging will kill lobster eggs and harm fish populations. He's afraid no one will want to come to San Juanico to surf or to see the whales that feed here, and that certainly no one will want to buy his catch. Aguilar and his colleagues aren't alone. Biologist Yanet Armandariz Villegas of Mexico's Instituto Politécnico Nacional here in Baja says there are a lot of unknowns about drilling underwater. But some things we do know.
O sea, la fosforita se acompaña de minerales como el uranio.
Armandariz says that phosphorus often comes with contaminants like uranium and cadmium, and that plumes generated from dredging can affect whole aquatic ecosystems.
Y es una zona especialmente vulnerable para la tortuga.
Armandariz says the mine would go in an especially important habitat for a population of endangered loggerhead turtles. So important, it's now a turtle refuge. Other underwater mines have been denied elsewhere around the world, and in April, Mexico's version of the EPA turned this one down too, because of the threats to the sea turtles. Since then, the project's backers have written a new application which outlines plans to protect the turtles. And opponents worry the mine could still be approved because the language defining the turtle refuge doesn't do anything to keep out industry. What it does mention is fishing, which complicates things even more. The day I arrived in San Juanico, the fishermen were hauling in their nets, maybe for good. There have been a lot of turtle deaths in this area, and there's some evidence that the fishermen's nets may be responsible. So they were told to stay off the water for 4 months to see if it is in fact their fault. Now the fishermen worry about an ironic outcome, that they might be out of business altogether while the underwater mine is allowed to go ahead. And there's another irony here as well. If Dana Cordell of the Phosphorus Institute is right, Mexico and the world may not even need this new source of phosphate.
About 80% of the phosphorus we're using is lost or wasted.
But she says it doesn't need to be lost forever.
If we're smart, we can capture and recover that phosphorus for reuse.
Instead of digging for more in sensitive places, Cordell says we should focus on efficiently using the phosphorus we already have. For The World, Nina Feldman, San Juanico, Mexico.
Nina's story was produced in collaboration with reporter Celia Guerrero and Round Earth Media. Remembering the silken voice propaganda of Hanoi Hannah, that's still ahead here on The World. This year's Nobel Prize winners are being announced this week and next. Each prize is worth about $1 million, and at the award ceremony in December, each winner will also receive a gold Nobel medal. But most of them will also get something a bit more obscure, a piece of original art meant to capture the essence of their work. The World's Carolyn Beeler is a fan of this Nobel art and is here to explain. Carolyn, I didn't know anything about this, didn't know art was part of it. Can it be any kind of art? Painting? Sculpture?
No, it's always 2D. So it's on a piece of paper about the size of a piece of regular computer paper. So it's usually a painting or a drawing or sometimes a collage. And it's sort of tucked into this fancy leather folio, kind of like a diploma cover, on the opposite side of the hand calligraphered prize certificate. And the thing that I really love about this idea is that this art is supposed to sort of capture the essence of the scientific or economic achievement that's being recognized. So it's this cool kind of melding of the scientific and the artistic. And I always think about how hard this must be for artists. So, for example, this year, the scientists who won the physics prize today are being recognized for, and I'm quoting here, theoretical discoveries of topological phase transitions and topological phases of matter. So can you imagine trying to sort of illustrate that?
Not at all. But what a great assignment to have.
Yeah.
So what does it look like, this art?
So my very favorite Nobel diploma art was a collage created by an abstract artist called Suzanne Yardebak for the pair of scientists who discovered the Higgs boson. And the Higgs is a subatomic particle that's been dubbed the God particle. And so she did this gorgeous collage that was aquamarines and dark blues and a little bit of gold to sort of evoke the heavens and sort of celestial beings to try to make you think about the God particle.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's another one that I like that's a little bit more straightforward. So a couple of years ago, you might remember that three Japanese scientists won a Nobel for their contribution to discovering blue LEDs.
I do.
So the artist that year did these watercolors in black and white and gray that were sort of silhouettes in men in overcoats and hats that were really sort of a study in light.
And I understand this is happening on a really tight deadline.
Yeah, that's true. The artists find out exactly the same time we do who the winners are, and then they have as little as a week to get sort of a sketch or an idea of their art to the calligrapher so that the calligrapher can match the ink color of the certificate to the art. And then they have about a month actually to deliver the final art to a fancy bookbinder in Stockholm.
It's hard not to notice the kind of level of care and detail. Why put so much effort into this part of the ceremony?
So the Nobel Prize Foundation really prides itself on a high level of attention to detail for the prize ceremony in December. And the idea is sort of to elevate science and scientists to sort of celebrity status for an evening, give them this opulent red carpet affair. So the king and queen of Sweden are at this prize ceremony. They're wearing their crowns and their sashes. So the actual physical prize is just part of that idea of really elevating economics and sciences and literature to sort of this glamorous level.
I can tell how much you love this. How did you stumble on it in the first place?
I've seen actually two of these in person. The first is in a library on Cape Cod at a scientific institution called the Marine Biological Laboratory. They have lots of cool little treasures there. And the other was in a lobby of a hospital in Germany. The hospital is named after the man who invented heart catheterization, and he won a Nobel Prize for that. So his Nobel is in the lobby there, and they're just really cool to see.
Carolyn Beeler covers science and the environment for The World. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thanks, Jeb.
Finally today, for Americans who served in the Vietnam War, this was a memorable voice.
How are you, G.I. Joe?
That's Chin Ti Ngo, known as Hanoi Hannah to American troops. She was one of the most recognizable voices of propaganda from North Vietnam during the war.
Nothing is more confused than to be ordered into a war to die or to be maimed for life without the faintest idea of what's going on.
Jean died Friday at the age of 87. The world's Chris Wolfe has been looking into her life.
Hanoi Hannah was hated by many U.S. troops. She even got a nod from Robin Williams in Good Morning Vietnam.
Oh, I'll get you, my pretty! Oh, my God, it's the Wicked Witch of the North! It's Hanoi Hannah!
I had a videotape of Good Morning Vietnam. So I know a little bit about the reaction of the GIs.
That's Chin speaking in a C-SPAN interview in 1992 in Ho Chi Minh City. Chin went by the name Thu Huong in her broadcasts. It means autumn fragrance. Autumn was her favorite season. Her job during the war was to demoralize GIs.
Isn't it clear that the war makers are gambling with your lives while pocketing huge profits?
Radio Hanoi pulled in GIs in the simplest way, through music. Thank you. The latest anti-war songs were always a favorite. But then sometimes U.S. soldiers like Captain Scott Lyman would hear an item targeted at them specifically. Here's Lyman talking in a documentary for PBS station KUED.
She would broadcast to people that Captain Lyman and his Blue Diamond Devils would be in the area that day, and that people who picked me up would be rewarded for doing so. And she put a price on my head of 500,000 piastres, I think it was, because we had done some damage to their people.
Lyman and others said they would laugh and throw beer cans at the radio if their unit or location got a particular mention. But intelligence like this could also freak out soldiers and Marines. It was only after the war that Cheen revealed that the main source of this intelligence was the U.S. military's own paper, Stars and Stripes, along with Time and Newsweek.
It seems to me that most of you are poorly informed about the going of the war, to say nothing about a correct explanation of your presence over here.
Cheen Teet Ngo was an unlikely revolutionary. She was born into a wealthy family in Hanoi. As a child, she fell in love with Hollywood movies, one in particular.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Yes, Gone with the Wind. Cheen begged her parents to help her learn English so she could watch it without subtitles, and she learned to love the language.
Frankly speaking, I like English a little better than French because the accent, it sounds very musical to the ear, shall we say.
Cheen was never a member of the Communist Party, but she was patriotic and believed in the revolution. So she volunteered to work for the English service of the Voice of Vietnam in 1955. She spent her entire career in broadcasting, switching from radio to TV in 1976. Hanoi Hannah may have been well known, but a poll of our online community of veterans today triggered a lot of hostile reactions, some of which are unrepeatable here. For her part, Cheen long ago decided to forgive America and let bygones be bygones. In fact,
my son is in the States. He's a painter.
Cheen Teet Ngo, Hanoi Hannah, died Friday in Ho Chi Minh City. For the world, this is Chris Wolfe.
And I'm Jeb Sharp. That'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.